Hey Trailblazers, this is Jason, your host of the Trailblazing Texas podcast. Before we jump into our latest episode, I've got some incredible news for you. Are you gearing up for your next big hike or backpacking trip? Well, we at Trailblazing Texas podcast have partnered up with Trekker Joe's, the ultimate Texas outfitter, to bring you something I feel absolutely special. Listeners, you of the Trailblazing Texas podcast can now get a one-time 15% off their gear purchases at Trekker Joe's. That's right. Whether you're a first-time customer at Trekker Joe's or a repeat customer like me, you can save big and hit the trails well-prepared. So upon checkout, use code TTP15 to claim your 15% discount and, in the process, support an amazing local Texas business. So happy trails, and don't forget to tell your hiking buddies. Now on with the episode. Welcome to the Trailblazing Texas podcast, where we embark on a journey through our diverse Texas landscapes and breathtaking trails while always engaging with our amazing Texas hiking community. So settle in, tighten up those bootlaces, and get ready for the thrilling tales awaiting for you on this episode.
What do you think are some ways that maybe someone that's not used to the area that could potentially kind of, make sure they don't end up in some of these situations with wildlife?
Yeah, I mean, obviously don't approach the dangerous animals. That's key there. If you do run into them, don't try to be friends and pet them, because they're not going to let you. Especially a mountain lion, they're gonna swipe at you, and you're gonna be missing some skin. So yeah, I mean, one thing I do is kind of stomp my feet, not aggressively necessarily, but I make my presence known, similar to the hay bear. Try to make my presence known as I'm hiking through areas where there's potential animals. A big thing is bears and mountain lions and javelinas and deer, they could all outrun you. So running's a bad idea in most cases, unless you can get to where you're no longer in view of that animal and then, you know, make your run for it. But running from an animal is a bad idea.
Yeah. And like running, doesn't that maybe trigger some kind of response from mm-hmm. them, like prey versus.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that you say that too, because just two nights ago, I'm walking out in the dark in an area where I'd just seen a couple of mountain lion kills. So I'm thinking maybe I shouldn't be acting like an injured deer or something, you know, and my stumbling steps along the rocky ground there, try to make that a little more stable so that I sound more like a healthy animal. And that I'm walking with a purpose and not stumbling off, you know, injured somewhere. So you do kind of want to portray like what a deer would do. Walk quietly in an area where you think you're going to disturb something. Walk loudly in an area where you're trying to warn things off. You know, deer will stomp their hoofs whenever they're trying to warn you to get away. So you're pretty much trying to act the same way as them, because to a mountain lion, other than the fact that you look weird and not like a deer and might be wearing clothing or something that looks unusual to them, you're easier to kill than a deer, because that deer can run pretty fast. He can jump over things like the mountain lion can. You can't do that. The only thing saving you is that they're not really used to you being a food source, and they're kind of scratching their head at what you are. So they're a little more sketched out, kind of like walking in the dark for us. They're kind of like walking blind into what is that thing? Is it going to be like a bear and be super strong and not look like it? Or am I going to be able to take this thing down? So looking weak, looking injured, you know, stuff like that can definitely draw some sort of instinct in those animals.
And I think you should always hike with someone a lot smaller than you too, because then they'll just pick them off and leave you
exactly
free.
You know, the other night, like you were saying, that mountain lion's going to just come up and get you from behind. You're not even going to know that it happened. So, you know, in the back of my mind, that's kind of where I'm at mentally. I'm waiting for that to happen. And, you know, you kind of keep an eye out from behind you. So even though I'm used to going out and doing those types of hikes, I'm still nervous when I'm in a situation where it just, you know, you kind of almost your intuition can kind of feel like, oh man, something feels like I'm vulnerable here. And so then you just have to kind of take whatever measures you can to make yourself feel less vulnerable, whether that be pull your headlamp out or start making those noises, kicking rocks around as you're walking, saying, hey, bear, lots of things like that, you know, having some sort of clanging tool on your pack that's making noises, you kind of like your bell you're talking about, you know. I generally like to be quiet when I'm out there, and not draw a lot of attention to myself. But when I do feel vulnerable, I do start kind of making that known, like, hey, there's something here and he might be aggressive.
Yeah. Do you guys have a lot of issues with people feeding the wildlife? Like, you see these stupid videos of these people that are in these cars and they're handing out food to bears, or they're trying to feed the moose or the elk. Or the buffaloes, bison, you know, I'm like, what idiots. And the issue is, it's those people aren't going to get in trouble. They're going to euthanize the animal because they start getting used to people and oh, okay, people equals food. And, you know, it gets me fired up.
Yeah. I don't see a lot of that here. The elk and deer are generally going to be, you know, far enough away. Bear and mountain lion, obviously, if someone did try to feed them, we never heard about it. I don't hear a lot about people feeding the animals. Maybe when you get into some of the state parks and stuff where you do have a lot more tourists, you might get a little bit of that. But we don't have a lot of animals that generally will be coming up to you to get fed. That are large mammals, usually, you know, the squirrels and chipmunks and stuff like that. You'll see people feeding those, but we don't have a lot of animals that are kind of more willing to come up to the vehicles like you do driving through where they have the, basically where you can feed the buffaloes and stuff. You know, there's like Arizona. I think you could feed some animals on there, but they're all pretty domesticated anyways.
Kind of want to touch on the hydration aspect of hiking in Arizona. I know we talked a lot about water. What is your opinions on water bladders?
I've actually still been using a water bladder. Recently I've been using the smart water bottles.
Yeah.
And yeah, I took them out. But because I do a lot of day hikes and generally kind of can tell where I'm at with a lot of that stuff, I feel a little bit more comfortable with it, with the bladder on those day hikes. But definitely on backpacking trips, it's the smart bottles and the filters. Because generally I'll pack in 3 or 4 bottles knowing I'm going to someplace that's going to have water. And if I get there and there is no water, it's time to turn around and that's not the trip I'm going to be doing anymore anyways. So I do still occasionally use my bladder. I like the ease of being able to just kind of reach down and pop the little hose in my mouth and take a sip. I don't like the taste of it as much either. So there's definitely a lot of downsides with the bladders. The good thing about the bladder for the day pack that I use is it's just a more narrow kind of smaller pack. And I could fit more water in the bladder in that pack than I can with the smart water bottles. And I'm saying that, and it's...
So what you're saying is you need a more manly day pack.
So
that I've fits the Trekker Joe water bottle sleeve holders.
You know what? I like those. Those are awesome.
Man, are they?
I have them on my backpack.
Changers. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah,
and you can.
I hate having to stop to pull my water bottle out.
Yes,
like that's the worst part.
You can carry so much water. You can front load it. as well as your hip belts. And man, it makes your backpack feel totally, totally different.
Yeah. Dude, I love those things.
So you got some, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember you telling me that you ordered some.
Yeah, I got one for a friend of mine too. I haven't really got any feedback from him, but again, we haven't really been doing any backpacking trips, so it hasn't been.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
I think I have six of them so far. Yeah. Nice. I'm trying to keep Joe in business.
I was watching your podcast. I think it was with Joe on the podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you were talking about all the different colors that you had in there.
Yeah, I'm trying to keep him in business. Like, it's just, I love gear. I don't care about gear reviews and I don't listen to gear reviews. But if something changes, like I have Z-Packs, Hyperlite, Ultras, Enlightened equipment, blah, blah, whatever. Like none of those have changed the game for me like a Trekker Joe's water bottle sleeve holder. And I know there's other brands and the other brands are a lot taller, like longer. And I hate that. And so this one is the perfect size. It's made in Texas, but that's not why I love it. Like I loved it before I knew it was made in Texas. But no, it's definitely a game changer for sure. So you being in Arizona, what do you think hikers can do to contribute to the preservation of the Arizona trails and its beauty? You know, I know for me, heading up to Guadalupe Mountains and then seeing people throw their banana peels, orange peels, toilet paper, like, oh, that just kills me. And, you know, like leave no trace principles and some of these things. But like, what do you think or what's important to you that hikers should do to just preserve the special place that you have, you know, your hiking trails and stuff?
Yeah, I think obviously the leave no trace. I mean, littering, it just doesn't make any sense. You know, the orange peels, people always think that those things are going to go away or be eaten by something. Nothing.
No, they're not.
They just dry out and they're just litter there forever.
So, yes.
Yeah. So obviously, yeah, not littering, but, you know, I'm a big proponent of off trail hiking. But there's limits to that as well. Because you get into areas where you have certain soils, like Sedona, you have the don't bust the crust, because there's this biological crust that's on top of the dirt that's taken, you know, decades, hundreds of years to get to the point where it's at. And that's what's holding that soil together so we don't have more erosion. So it doesn't seem like a big deal to go make a footprint in that. But that footprint just took away just so much of the ability of that soil to hold itself together. So you have a lot of erosion that happens. You have trails that just get wider and wider because people are not really respecting that. So even though I like to do a lot of off-trail hiking, I know that staying away from stepping on that type of soil or staying away from like breaking branches, I try to move with the plants and move through the plants. So try not to break branches, try not to step on plants that are critical. I don't step on bugs and stuff like that. Even the ones that are meant to be the not pretty bugs and stink bugs that people don't like, you know, you don't need to kill those bugs. You're in the middle of nowhere. You're not at your house in your living room. So, you know, respecting the animals and other people's ability to go enjoy those places, you know, drawing graffiti. That's another one. You see graffiti at some places and it's like, it's not even good graffiti. I can understand if they took the time and had like a really nice thing somewhere kind of out of the way. But most of the graffiti I see is just like someone took their car key and scratched into the stall of the porta potty or something, you know. It's all very badly done. And I see it right over the top of petroglyphs all the time too. So you have somebody that went to this special place that people die to find. Like, I love going and finding petroglyphs. And, you know, especially ones that nobody had to take me to. They're not well known and on a list. And you get out to one of those and it's like, not many people find those. And then you see modern graffiti that's like 10 years old on there or less. And it's like, man, that one.
I would, right there. I pray that I would get on a jury with someone being prosecuted for that kind of shit.
Yeah.
That is another thing on my bucket list.
Yeah, it's just, it's, you know, it's one thing to just out of the blue. There's plenty of people that did it in the late 1800s, early 1900s, carving their name in. You know, if it's done in a place that's not super common, okay, I can see it. You know, I'm not against that for people. But when you're doing it over history, trying to put your mark over the top of that history, that's super annoying.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny that you say like breaking that crust and then facilitating erosion. It's the same thing when you cut a switchback.
Mm-hmm.
Walk the extra 10 steps to where it's supposed to turn and, you know, like where the switchback happens. Don't cut that because now you've just created an aspect of erosion, right? Like, that also, and I'm just to stand corrected, like I used to not think it was a big deal until I actually got older and started, you know, maturing and really thinking about this stuff. You know, there's a reason why they don't want you to do that, because you're facilitating now erosion and destruction of the trails. And
you walk through one of those and you create a new way for water to drain, and now that water's draining down that and taking out the trail, and so now that trail has to be fixed, or people are just gonna, you know, have to hop over a big rut in the middle of it. But yeah, it changes it a lot. You see that when you hike trails often, you can see what that little bit of destruction does long term to it over a while.
Absolutely. So I know we talked about mountain lions and bears. How many times do people get bit by snakes?
Honestly, I've never been with anyone that's been bitten or known anyone that's been bitten by a non-venomous or by a venomous snake. And then all the bites that I know of are from someone picking the snake up. So, you know, I've not been bitten over the last 3 years of my hiking and all my adventures with snakes and everything, even picking them up, because there is a way to do that to still respect the animal, make them not feel like they're about to be eaten or crushed or whatever the case is. So there is still kind of like that little bit of, you know, wiggle room where you can do those things if you're doing them in a way that the animal doesn't feel threatened. But yeah, I mean, picking up a snake, especially a venomous snake, without being a trained professional is not the best idea, because you can pick up a rattlesnake, you could watch a movie and you could see how they do it, but what I've learned is you kind of start to feel what the animal's thinking by their presence and their body language and their eye movements and how tense they are. So, you know, someone that has been handling a venomous snake can pick up on those things and realize, oh yeah, I have it by the tongs or I have it by the snake hook, and I could feel it about to move its body, and it's going to move it this way, which is going to cause it to be able to bite.
Yeah.
I need to respond this way to prevent that, where amateurs don't understand that. So it's always a bad idea for someone that doesn't know what they're doing to even get near a venomous snake. And then,
but just kind of like just normally hiking, do you guys have a lot of just, I'm just walking on the trail and then get popped?
No. I would say your biggest chance with a rattlesnake of getting bit and no one messing with it would be if you're walking along a trail with a group of people, or with a trail that's kind of populated and has a decent amount of people. I would say that the first person might walk by it, second person might walk by it and the third person might get bit, because if that snake has thought that its camo is not working anymore, it might decide to strike it, and they can strike without rattling. You don't need a rattlesnake to warn you first.
Yeah.
But most of the time, I mean, I get within 2 feet of rattlesnakes all the time, and kind of in their bubble and in their striking range, but you could kind of feel it and you could see it. They don't want to strike you. So those strikes that do happen is most likely the snake thought, okay, the first person walked by, I got away with it. Second person made them a little more nervous. And then the third person, I need to do attack because I'm under attack. They don't understand. You're just walking by them. So it is still important to keep an eye out for those snakes. They are hard to spot, especially if you're walking fast. They're camo. They're designed to blend in with their background. So their camo and their patterns actually kind of are what allow you to see them once you start looking for them, because they do stand out once you start looking for them. If you're just generally walking by, not paying attention, that camo works great. The corner of your eye, you're not going to see that snake. If you're looking for a pattern, you're looking for kind of a rock that doesn't look normal, then you can kind of spot them beforehand. But yeah, generally it's not a risk that you're going to be bitten by a rattlesnake just walking on a trail. If you're walking on a trail and you step on it, most likely it's going to run away from you, or you're going to back up and it's going to sit there in a defensive stance, rattling its tail until it finally realizes you're not advancing on it. Then it'll turn around and scurry off. There's not a single time I've ever had a rattlesnake get closer to me after it's started rattling. It might come closer to you when you're just sitting there enjoying your meal or something. It'll just kind of think you're an inanimate object and try to come past you or something. But after it's gotten defensive, after it's had to sit there and start rattling its tail, it's pretty much saying, next window I get to run away, I'm going to run away. And that's what they do every time. So, it's not really that big of a risk that people are so concerned about. Now, it is still, if you're walking in taller grass or on a trail where they could possibly be off to the side or something, there's always still a risk, but it's not that large.
Yeah, like when I'm on the Lone Star hiking trail, copperheads and water moccasins, I would say I see more coral snakes than anything, and then probably water moccasins, because we're constantly going in creek beds that sometimes are dried out or sometimes have water, and then probably copperheads. And every time I'm hiking, I'm thinking in my mind, poop on the trail, poop on the trail, poop on the trail, because a water moccasin looks like it poop on the trail. And so that's how I keep my mind just constantly, time that I've almost stepped on a water moccasin, I was like, oh, I don't want to step on that poop. And I'm like, oh, wait, that's a water moccasin.
Yeah. That's kind of the one good thing about Arizona is we don't have venomous snakes that aren't rattlers. I mean, I'm saying that, but we do have coral snakes and some other venomous snakes, but you're not going to run into venomous snakes on trails other than rattlers that are really of a risk. So you have that warning attached to their tail versus the water moccasins, not going to have that. You might get a little bit of white mouth showing at you as a defense, but they're not rattling their tails. Although some animals will still kind of mimic it and rattle the leaves or something near them. But yeah, it's actually kind of great knowing that our venomous snakes are giving us a little bit of a warning.
What about scorpions? Does that play a, I don't know, maybe you could have anaphylactic shock to a sting or something, but I think it's probably like a bee sting or something, that it's not really that pretty big much of a deal. Yeah.
Yeah. I used to get some of the bark scorpions, which is Arizona's most toxic venom, the one that does the most damage, I guess. I used to get those in my house at my last house, and I got stung 5 times in one night. It just kind of kept hitting me in different spots before I realized what was happening. And yeah, it hurts. Holy crap. It's annoying, but it is. It's just like a bee sting. It mm-hmm. hurts. It can feel numb. My ankle was numb for like 2 days because I think I got stung twice there or something. You know, it just was more concentrated on my ankle. And so that was kind of numb for a couple days, but it wasn't where I ever felt like I needed medical attention. But yeah, if you have allergies, there's the potential for it to be more of an impact to you, like anaphylactic shock, or you start getting some swelling or something where you might need to get like an antibiotic or something. But generally, they're fairly safe. Generally, you're not going to have one crawling on you or anything while you're out on a hike. Now, if you're camping, backpacking, especially if you're cowboy camping, I don't know. I could never camp without a tent in Arizona just because the rattlesnakes are looking for warmth. They might come and snuggle up with you. And at night, the tarantulas and the scorpions are out wandering. Granted, they're not going to attack you while you're sleeping, but if they come cuddle with you like the rattlesnake, you're going to wake up and you're going to move around and then they'll sting you. So
right now, could you take a black light in your backyard on your house and find a scorpion?
I hope not. I pay a lot of money to not have bugs in my yard, but I do live on the edge of the desert. So there is that possibility. I know historically at this house, I've been here about 6 years, and historically I haven't had any bark scorpions. I've had a couple of the desert harries, which are the biggest ones that we have, but they're also a little more calm, mild. In fact, just posted a picture of me holding one that me and my friend Adam were picking up and holding a couple months ago. So yeah, there's some around. Luckily, I don't think I have a whole lot in my yard at this house. My last house, I could go outside with a black light every night and pick at least 5 to 10 off the block wall.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, they were everywhere. So that's where I was getting a few of those in the house. My mom got stung, I got stung, my dog got stung. But you know, it's a minor annoyance. In fact, when I was stung, I was actually sleeping on the couch in my basement, and I was kind of in my mind, I was in bed, and the first thing I was like, oh man, there's gotta be something in the bed. You know, it almost felt like there was glass shards in the bed. And so it kind of started working its way down my body on one side of my body, because I think I was probably laying on my side, and it stung my shoulder, then it stung my hip, then it stung my knee, then it stung my ankle. And each time, like, it kind of woke me up. It kind of like made me aware something was going on. But like I said, it felt like a glass shard was in the bed. So after the final sting, I was kind of sitting there for a while, and it finally dawned on me. I woke up enough to realize, wait, this still hurts. This isn't a dream. I'm not even in bed. So what I thought was happening can't be happening. And then it dawned on me, it's gotta be a scorpion. So I did. I grabbed my black light because, you know, living there at that house, a black light was kind of a fun thing to do. But it was, you know, that was my pest control, going out with a black light. So I grabbed that thing and I flipped the couch over, threw all the cushions everywhere, and finally found that little son of a bitch and seeked my revenge.
Yeah, that's and it probably, like you said, like it's like a bee sting, but it's, or like a tarantula biting you, you know, it's like a bee sting, but it's the way the thing that's biting you looks makes it probably way more worse, like a tarantula or a scorpion. I just stumbled across my first Texas brown tarantula at Guadalupe Mountains, and I've been looking for them, and I always miss their breeding season, never get that right. But
yeah,
I mean, it was really neat. You know, it was chill. I poured some water in front of it. I just wanted to see what it would do. And it like crawled over the water and just kind of like sat in it. And then I'm like, okay. And yeah, it was cool. And it was a bucket list item that I got to knock off. You know, you were talking about was it the hieroglyphics and stuff?
Yeah, so petroglyphs.
Yeah, petroglyphs. What role does the Arizona Native American history play in your hiking culture?
For me, the Native American history is one of my favorite things. I love going out, finding ruins, finding petroglyphs and pictographs, and just kind of absorbing that energy that you feel when you're out in those areas. You know, you feel like you're in an area that has a lot of history. You know, you realize those Native Americans weren't living there for 60 years. They were living there for hundreds of years. So generations passed through there, you know, and you start to kind of think of that. And to me, that's really special. I love going out and finding those areas. That's one of the main things I spend my time doing. If I'm not wandering around hiking, I'm usually out looking for ruins, or know of some ruins in an area, or know of an area that's maybe kind of possibly got something or had something in the past, you know. So I spend a lot of time in those areas to try to see them all, honestly. I mean, you get that vandalism like we're talking about. You know, people go and they some of them will do it intentionally, most of them don't, but they'll knock walls down, whole walls. It'll be a 4-foot wall one day, and then you go there the next day and it's crumbled because people are leaning against them or wanted to take a cool picture on top of it or whatever the case may be. And then there's people that do it on purpose just because they're like, oh, you know, there's none of them left, so why do we care? You know, it's like the disrespect on it is pretty rough. So I try to get to all those areas. I'm trying, you know, like that's a goal of mine, is to see them all, even though you can't see them all because you don't know about all of them. But that's one of the things that it's like, I try to spend my hiking and the years I have left of life going and seeing those things, just as like a, almost like a bucket list item for me to see all of them.
And so the state doesn't protect these sites?
Yeah, they're legally protected. So there are laws that if you were to damage anything or take anything, or leave graffiti or anything like that, there are laws and they will go after you if they can find you. That's the problem is, they'll have site stewards that will monitor some areas. There'll be some trail cameras out there, and you know, they've gotten pretty fancy with those nowadays, and usually they're projecting the footage directly to somebody's phone. So if they see something going on, you know, they can report it. There'll be little hidden cameras everywhere you go, and that's kind of one of the things that got me learning to respect it from the beginning. Not that I was trying to disrespect it, but you start thinking in the back of your head, oh man, there's cameras here, or there potentially could be, and I just don't realize it. So it's like, you want to respect it, but you also are realizing, man, there's got to be some heavy penalties for damaging these things. But generally, there's a lot of just very off trail, out in the wilderness stuff that is known about because they have documented all these sites. I mean, obviously, there's very little of our country that people haven't stepped foot on. So they are somewhat documented somewhere, but it's not like public knowledge. It's not something you can go generate a list for most of those things. You get into some of the other sites that are more popular that will have people checking on them daily. They will have there's a lot of the national monument ones that are really nice to go see. Obviously, you know, you either have to pay the entry fee or have the America the Beautiful pass on those. And those are protected pretty heavily. I mean, there's always somebody there for the most part. A lot of places you'll have to do guided tours for you to even be able to access it. But there's still tons out here in Arizona that is just out in the middle of nowhere, not well known. It's not like, you know, you're going to be able to even name that. For the most part, you just kind of have to generalize what natives even lived in those areas, because you can't just go and Google search the waypoint and find out what the history of it was. It'd be nice if you could, but
So how awesome is it to have planned something where you don't really know if it's there or not, and to walk around the corner and there it is?
Yeah, that's super exciting. Yeah, I get into that fairly often, because I have a couple friends that will plan trips like that, and I won't even know what we're going to go see sometimes. And, you know, so I'm like, okay, I know we're going to be trying to go find this ruin or this cave or this whatever, and I'm not really certain what it's going to look like or any history on it or anything. So you get to one of those and you're like, oh, whoa, okay. This is way different than, you know, in my mind, I may have had something built up. And then you start to feel that energy again. You start to kind of feel like, wow, you know, this, there's something special about this. So yeah, I get into that quite often. And I also find things, usually not very substantial things, but I do often find things on my own as I'm just generally kind of wandering around in the wilderness. And those finds are super exciting, because you're not even expecting, you know, okay, maybe I might find something cool or a new bug or a new snake or something, but yeah, you're never expecting to just walk up on, oh, wow, there's ruins here. And, you know, you will go hiking a lot of Arizona and find broken pottery sherds along the trail. So you kind of know that there's a lot of native history, and they covered the whole state. So, you know, you have large pockets of stuff like that. But when you get into the middle of nowhere and you're not even really expecting anything, you're not seeing a whole lot of sign, and then you pop up on something, it's super exciting. It's special.
That, you know, and that's one of the reasons why I love the Guadalupe Mountains so much. You know, there's a B-24 plane crash out there that I found. Mm-hmm. It took me 3 times to find it. I researched it off and on for a couple of years. Went out twice with my son. We could have found it, but we turned back because the way I was going, dropping down this canyon, it was a little dangerous, and I didn't want to put the responsibility on him if something happened to me. And then I took a group out from Midland, Odessa, their Facebook hiking group. It was 5 or 6 of them. And, you know, they had the same coordinates, and they were going to go the way that I went twice. And I'm like, look, you know, when we go, I want to go this new way because it's dangerous going this way, but I want to go over one more peak. Then it's a shallow drop down into this river, this dry wash, mm-hmm. and then walk back, you know, kind of pretty flat, walk back and then go up to it. And, they're like, yeah. And so, you know, it felt a lot of pressure on me. Like, I want to mm-hmm. do this new unexplored way. They agreed. So, you know, we went out there, and man, it was kind of funny because Kip, you know, I'm walking, and I probably walk about 200 yards past the part where we need to go up. And he's like, hey, man, I think you passed where we need to go up. And I'm like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
You know, you start walking up, and then all of a sudden you see a little piece, and you're like, oh, wow. And then you mm-hmm. see a propeller, and then you see, you know, like whatever. And then it's just like spread out over probably 200 to 300 yards. And, you know, we're all just over just walking, being very respectful. And then I start heading over to the left, and there's just this massive piece of the fuselage. And, you know, and there's a plaque, and oh man, it was just,
yeah. Awesome.
And also the same thing, there was an old Mexican Apache grave that I found from February of 1855. The guy was killed by the Apache Indians. He was a scout for the Buffalo soldiers that were protecting the Butterfield Stagecoach in that area. And I heard about his grave from a gentleman in Van Horn that owned a restaurant, like an elderly man that I used to yeah. always talk to. And so it took me a while to find that, but, you know, I go visit Jose's grave every time I go to Guadalupe, and I sit and hang out with him. We talk he doesn't talk to me, but yeah. I see him for about 30 minutes. And, you know, the grave is probably the headstone. It's probably 3 feet tall, you know, and it's Jose Maria Ponceco, guide killed by Indians, February 1855. And the it was not this October, but this past February when I was out there, probably a week or two before I went out there, I actually found the letter from his captain to his superior of actually how Jose died. It was in a Mexico archive. So, yeah. So like, you know, I can relate to you finding things and, you know, doing the research probably. And, you know, I think what I like most about it is the failures, right? Like it just brings you back. And it's not easy. And, you know, if you were always successful, what fun would that be? Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I have some ruins. I know exactly where they're at, and I failed getting to them twice now. So, yeah. I mean, they're difficult to get to. They're difficult to find. So, it's you're not always going to hit it every target. So I know a lot of times we'll have three or four things planned to hit in a day, and we might only find one of them. We might spend the whole day looking for all of them, but we'll only find one of them. You know, you got to get excited about that one you find, and then just hopefully something else kind of made your day on the other ones, even though you didn't find the target. You know, you may have found a snake, or you know, had a bird flying above you. I don't know. So many things get me excited. It's you got to find those little things to keep your interest in it. So, you know, I see a new bug I've never seen before, I get all excited. I want to make a TikTok of it. So TikToks never do any good. Nobody likes my bug TikToks, but
I like them. And Trailblazing Texas Podcast likes them.
Yeah.
Do you keep, like, when you find these historical sites, do you have your own little markers on your map of to where all these things are?
Nice. Yeah, I have a lot of things marked on my map that I've been to, things I want to go to, other areas that I'm just kind of suspicious of, that there might be something there, or just it'd be kind of cool to check out. I have a friend in California. He's an elder man that's retired. He'll actually send me some stuff that to go check out that he finds on Google Images and stuff, Google Maps and stuff. So he'll kind of search around and find things. I'll do that myself sometimes. You know, you could find some hilltop ruins or some random things that you kind of want to check out. Oh, it looks like this used to be a mining camp or something. So you just kind of mark them, and then you get out there and it turns out it was just a shadow on Google Maps and it was nothing. You know, sometimes that happens, but
yeah, absolutely.
You just got to kind of take the wins with the losses sometimes when it comes to it.
So what about, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but what about, like, is there a lot of history out there for like mining and pioneering? I mean, you think like Arizona is kind of like, you know, you Wild West, Tombstone and mining and all that stuff. So how is that kind of related to like what you do and stuff like that?
Yeah. I mean, going to mines is another big one for me. I like, you know, anything that's man-made, that's out in the middle of nowhere, that's kind of historical. So mines are definitely one of those things. You know, I like to get a headlamp on and go into those mines and travel them and see what they're about. There's mines everywhere here in Arizona. With all the mountains, there was plenty of gold, silver, all kinds of other non-precious metals. We have tons of copper that's currently being mined. So there's a ton of mining history here. You find a lot of old ranching history too, a lot of like stone walls, stone corrals and stuff like that. It's just stacked rocks. It's silly to get excited about them, but you know, people that are into it, we're into it. So I got to see every stacked rock that there is, you know, whether it's ruins or cowboys or whatever it was. You know, sometimes you can't tell the difference between, you know, how old something is. Is this something a Native American made, or just something a random hunter or camper made? You know, you can't tell sometimes because the mortar that held everything together kind of erodes away on a lot of the ruins. So you get up to the top of a hill and you just see kind of squares made in the dirt that are made of rock. And that's a ruin. That used to be a village. Yeah. You know, that you could tell there was like four or five rooms built on that thing, you know. It was a whole family that
that's there. Crazy.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, sometimes that's all it is. It's just like an outline of walls on the ground. It's nothing too, you know, I can't even think of the word, but spectacular. There we go. So you get into it, but man, I tell you, everybody I know that looks for ruins gets excited about that little square on the ground of stacked rocks. You feel it. You could feel that energy up there, that it's just all that history, all the different things that those people experienced, sitting there having to make tools out of rocks and make their own clothing and everything, you know. You just kind of, you have to think that those people sat there and survived out there where you're like, oh, I'm dying because I didn't bring enough water. They had to carry their water hundreds of feet up a mountain and store it in their ruins, or not ruins, but their pueblos. Yeah. And you look out there and you're like, man, where did they get firewood from? Where did they get water from? And you could see that's why a lot of the civilizations had to move away, because over time the landscape changed, the demographic of everything that they were doing there changed with droughts or even just snow and iced over times, you know. So you have all kinds of things out there that you can go find, and they all have all that history to them. The Arizona as a state hasn't been around very long, but you look at the history that, you know, of all the things that have happened in these mountains, and it goes back, you know. There's a lot of Spanish mining that happened way back in the day here, 1500s or whatever it was, you know. You got just tons and tons of history out there, and you had the natives fighting with the Spaniards, you had the settlers and everything fighting with the natives and the Spaniards. So it's, you know, you kind of get out there and you start to kind of feel that energy. And to me, it's just a special thing.
You know, and it's funny that you say that, like how you can get to these places and just feel, you know, talking to Pam, and one of the things that I love about her is, like, you know, you meet people and, you know, they just have a connection to the mountains. They have a connection to something that I don't have, that is beyond my comprehension. And, you know, so sitting here, you know, there's been a lot of deaths in Guadalupe Mountains, you know, whether it's the pilots on the plane crash, whether it's just people from natural causes, the old Indians that lived there, the Buffalo soldiers. So there's been a lot of, and, you know, she'll be out in the backcountry by herself, cowboy camping, because she's in the middle of a rescue or something. Or she's just out there, you know, checking people's permits, and, you know, she'll hear footsteps behind her. She'll turn around, no one's there. And so she's just like, all right, well, she's talking to whatever that was. All right, well, today we're going to go to Tejas Trail, and we're going to cut over to Blue Ridge, and then we're going to come back down Bush. If you want to go with me, let's go. And, you know, she just, and, you know, and I absolutely, you know, it's like you said, you get up to these places and you just feel, you feel it, right? Like you just, and it's absolutely spectacular. And I know when I'm in the back country, nothing crazy has happened to me, but I always take time just to kind of be by myself and just experience whatever Guadalupe has for me. Just nobody's around me. I'm not talking. I'm just sitting there just in a kind of a chill mode and just absorbing all the energy that Guadalupe has to give me at that moment. And it's absolutely spectacular.
Yeah. I feel the same way. You gotta kind of take a few moments out there. I'm usually kind of chugging away hiking, but, you know, every now and then you get a nice little break to sit there and just kind of, there's not even a whole lot of noise going on. It's not like you hear tons of frogs and birds everywhere and, you know, bears huffing in the background, but you got, it's just like it's not silence, but it's also not loud noise. It's just kind of a presence.
Yeah. It, you know how many TikTok videos I've tried to make in Guadalupe Mountains, and I'm making the video and there's not one peep of anything. Uh-huh. And I'm like, no wind, no, just dead silence. And I'm like, man, no one's going to like that video.
That's why I put music to my videos, because there's never noise. People are like, why do I like the original audio? I'm like, well, that's cool if I'm like somewhere where there is audio, but most of the time it's just me huffing and puffing or literally no noise at all.
Yeah, a lot of times it's me going.
Every time I watch a video, I'm like, oh, I was holding my breath. There's not going to be any noise. No, I look at it. Now you can still hear me breathing somehow. I'll hold my breath for like 2 minutes while recording something, and then I'll watch the video and you can hear me breathing. I guess I wasn't holding my breath.
So when you go out to find these areas and you kind of have a trip, how do you mentally and physically prepare for this stuff? This question was kind of related to hiking, but now we got onto like the ruins, and I love that kind of stuff. So like, what kind of goes through in your world about getting ready for this type of thing? And how are you, I guess physically just walking and hiking and stuff, you're good, but like mentally, like, okay, plan B's if something goes wrong, like how do you get ready for it?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, the Garmin's obviously the biggest plan B that could save me in the biggest scenarios. But a big thing is just making sure that you're not feeling ill when you start. Obviously, you get into pre-hydrating, drinking plenty of water before you get out there, not waiting until you get out there to start chugging your water, so that you're already hydrated. And then you have to start actually making that sweat happen before you're needing to take more water in. So kind of getting prepared that way is usually one of my big things. Another big thing for me is after I get done hiking, I like to ice my knees, because I do take a lot of impact on my knees. I don't use any type of trekking poles or anything. I'll often jump down a lot on the trails. So I take a lot of impact on the knees. So I have some ice packs that are in a knee brace, and usually I'll just kind of throw those on there till they get warm. I try to do that. I haven't been great about it lately, but I try to do that after every hike. And that's kind of getting me ready for the next day's hike. And being someone that likes to hike daily, it's important to not kind of wear on my knees so much that, yeah, I might be uncomfortable the next day, but if I get to the point where I can't hike that day, it really bums me out, because I do try to maintain that daily hiking record, not for anything else other than just my own kind of mental like pleasure I get from doing that on a daily basis and having that track record. So yeah, that, just kind of taking care of myself afterwards. You know, I'll take like a hot bath sometimes and kind of relax my muscles that way. But getting my body prepared for that next brutal hike, you know, sometimes I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, this past Friday, I went to, I did one of the another harder hikes in the Superstitions called Battleship. So it's about 5 to 6 miles to get out to Battleship, and then it's about four or five miles, then you have to hike up on the top of Battleship and then hike all the way back. So it ends up being about 11 and a half to 12 miles depending on what all you kind of do. I didn't plan for that at all. You know, I didn't start my day off knowing that's what I was going to do. I got out to the trailhead and then just kind of decided as I started walking, that's where I was going to be. So I can't really necessarily prepare for those hikes, because I'm not ever really sure what I'm going to do. So taking care of myself after I get back from the hike is just as important as what I do before I go out.
Okay. And so I really like this question. And it's amazing once you start getting in the outdoors, how this happens. But so how has hiking and getting outdoors influenced your relationship with nature?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have, like I said, I used to never even see the mountains. So getting out and hiking now, I kind of like picking up new things. I like even if it's not hiking related, I start kind of picking up on new things to go do out in nature, to try to spend as much time out in nature as I possibly can. So if that's fishing or paddleboarding or riding on a boat, I try to get out in nature every day so that I can maintain that just constant track record of it, like I was talking about. And I actually kind of get really bummed out on days where I can't do it and can't get out there. So it's definitely connected me. My mental health is reliant on getting out there and getting out into nature now. It's a necessity at this point.
Yeah. I know for me, like, it's really opened my eyes to how destructive we are as a society. And also, if everybody would just do a little bit, what an impact we could make in a positive way. Like, you know, just walking a trail, having a trash bag and just picking up trash. It's almost like a maturity that's happened to me. Mm-hmm. And just to understand how we impact nature. Also from a historical aspect, like, history is cool. Like, I wish mm-hmm. I could go back in school, in junior high and high school, and really pay attention to history, because like the stuff that you are experienced with, and the mining, the Native American history, the ruins, you know, the stuff that we have in Texas, like, it's just so cool. And before hiking and stuff, I didn't really care about it, but mm-hmm. the whole process of learning about something, researching it, having a plan to go out and try to find it, and then not finding it, and then you do find it, and it's mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah, it is kind of like, you know, you see people littering on the trail, and it's like, come on, man, you don't need to leave your trash out in the middle of nowhere and disrespect all the people that are coming out here. Yeah, I see trash everywhere. You know, and it's funny because you see trash from decades ago too. You see all the people that were mining left all their oil cans and all the canned food cans that they had. And especially now in the burned area, I was just walking the Superstitions the last 2 days, and massive burned areas. You go through and it's just cans everywhere. And it's crazy how many beer cans and old food cans and oil cans I find.
Some of those glass bottles and stuff that like pioneers and stuff left, it's worth a little money. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, when you see the older stuff, it is still history. It's kind of like seeing old graffiti. You know, it's like, oh, okay, graffiti from 1901, that's cool. Graffiti from 2001, nah, I don't like that as much. You know, so you see an old beer can and it's like, oh, that's kind of cool. It doesn't have the same opening in the mouth anymore, you know, and you can still see the label on them sometimes. To me, that's always cool. So it's litter, but it's cool litter. So maybe one day I don't know what people are leaving out there, their water bottles. Maybe one day we'll find those to be cool. I don't know.
Yeah. So kind of getting back to hiking, what do you think is the best time of year to hike in Arizona?
Definitely the spring, because you're starting to get, you know, some rain, you're getting a lot of new blooms and stuff. All the cactus have beautiful flowers. Unfortunately, a lot of the cactus and a lot of the wildflowers don't bloom at the same time. You can kind of see them progress over time, which ones bloom, and you know, they kind of follow a path. But yeah, seeing the Arizona desert with green everywhere and flowers is amazing. So summer's still cool. You can find plenty of places to hike in the summer, especially if you're going to go hike in Flagstaff. Summer's kind of better to hike Flagstaff. You don't have snow on the ground. You know, you have still decent weather. So, but yeah, spring, I think, covers most of Arizona. Fall's definitely up there, too. And that's mostly just temperature-wise. And you're still going to get flowers growing in the summer. It's not as much, but you know, you have a lot of like the monsoon season, which is kind of the middle to late summer. You'll get a lot of clouds and rainstorms and stuff. We didn't have a lot this year, but a lot of the clouds make for beautiful scenery and stuff. So it's kind of backwards to what you would think. You know, on a cloudy day, you kind of see a lot more details with the landscaping that you can't see on a sunny day because it's just so bright and just glaring. And some of my least favorite videos that I take are on cloudless days because it almost seems like the saturation is turned way up on my video because how much sun there is there. It just, the colors don't look right. So catching some nice clouds during the monsoon season is always great too.
Oh, I bet you it's spectacular. So as we start to kind of wrap up, what do you think or for someone coming to visit Arizona to get connected to the hiking scene, whether it's, you know, to research stuff, books, websites, any local podcast, what would you recommend for a non-Arizonian? I don't know if that's a word, but to really get connected kind of before they embark on, on traveling to Arizona, just to help them in the research and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I think Facebook is probably what I would say is the best platform to get other people's experiences. There's a lot of hiking pages specific to Arizona, Hike AZ, Hike Junkies. There's a lot of places that you can go on and see what people are doing. And then you can ask them questions and everything, obviously, in the comments. But I think a lot of those group pages that are specific to Arizona is going to be your best bet to just get the widest spectrum of ideas. Mm-hmm. All Trails is a good place to pull ideas. I don't put a lot of faith in it. The trails can kind of be incorrectly marked sometimes, but in general,
a lot of the times.
Yeah. In general, what I do is get like the basic gist of what the trail is from All Trails, and then I'll follow my own map to make sure I'm kind of staying on that. Especially since I don't pay for All Trails. I know if you pay for it, you can kind of track yourself in the app. But that one's a good one because you can go into, you know, say you don't know you're going to be in Sedona that day, but you end up there. You can pull up hikes in the area on that pretty easily. And you're going to only be doing the popular trails if you're from out of state or whatever anyways. So you're typically not going to be looking for a lot of the more backwoods things. You're going to be looking for the iconic things. And I think All Trails is a good place for that.
And so what apps would you recommend?
I really don't use a lot of apps. Just basically my Onyx, I use that a lot for kind of navigational, also just planning future trips, seeing how to get through the topography that I'm in, because there's a topography function in that. You could download offline maps on that, as many as you want, so that if you know you're going to be in an area there's not going to be cell phone service, you could download a more detailed map, because the tracking function works, the app works with no cell phone service, but you're not going to see the landscape and the topography as well if you're offline and you don't have an offline map saved. So that's kind of one of the benefits to doing that. If you know where you're going to be, you could download that offline map and have a little bit better of an experience navigating through an area that's not on a trail. Because I'll get to a part where, okay, I know I got to walk around this way. And then if I climb up and over, kind of like you were saying with that, the bomber wreckage, you know, it's easier if I climb over this way and then walk around this way versus trying to climb up over this way and go this way. Yeah. So having that ability to look that up, because a lot of like your Google Earth and all that aren't going to work out there. But so the OnX is the main app I use, and then AllTrails and Facebook. That's it. That's all I use. Yeah.
All right. So this is tradition. These are the last two questions of our podcast. I've asked one of the questions on every podcast, and then Henning said, oh, you should also ask about the gear. So that I added after his. So it's almost on every podcast. So the first question, what is one piece of safety advice? And I know we talked about a lot, but what is your main piece of safety advice for hiking in Arizona for a new hiker or backpacker?
Honestly, the OnX, because tracking yourself, knowing where you're at, you can mark where you parked, or you can mark the nearest city, or mark where you're trying to get to. Mm-hmm. And you could always see that dot. You might not be able to, you could see your track, you could see that dot, you could figure out which direction your phone's pointing, so that you could say, I need to be over there, but my map's oriented north and south. That's kind of hard for me to understand. You hit the button on it, it directs you in which way your phone's pointing, so that you could actually kind of turn like a compass and say, okay, that's the way I need to walk in that direction. So for me, that's my biggest thing, being off trail, out in the middle of nowhere, having that ability to see where I've been, so that if I drop something or if I just need to backtrack that specific way. I've been to many peaks where getting down, you get kind of confused where the trail is. So I can actually look at where I've been and make my way back down the trail more easily. So that is the biggest one for me, even over the Garmin, because self-rescue is more important than having the ability for somebody else to rescue you.
And it's cheaper.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's $100 a year versus $60,000.
Yeah.
For me, the safety is don't use a water bladder.
Yeah. Yeah, for real. That leaked on me that time. And that's funny because, you know, we were kind of just starting our friendship at that time.
Yes.
And exactly. I already knew your position on the bladders. So that was the first thing I had to, you were the first person I had to tell about my bladder leaking.
Yeah.
That was funny.
No, and all joking aside, it's not the bladder, you know, hike your own hike to the listeners. For me, the safety advice, and I say this every time, it's just tell somebody your itinerary verbally that I'm going to this place. I'm probably going to start hiking around this time. I'm going to estimate my return this time. I should be back home by this time. And if you get to that area and you realize, okay, you're going to change your itinerary, and you let someone know, that person, don't change your itinerary until they confirm back to you that they know you've changed your itinerary. And then even if you don't have Garmin and all these fancy things, there's someone that knows what you're doing, and when you're supposed to be home, and will send out the Air Force if you don't return on that time. So like that's, you know, you don't even, there's no cost, no nothing. Just send a text or write a note. Make sure someone acknowledges your itinerary and don't change it.
You know, you could also, I know we're talking about not using Garmin, but on the Garmin, you can actually share your tracking with a loved one or, you know, whoever you told you're going out, you can actually share that with them so they could see your progression and where you're at. And then, oh, he hasn't moved in a day. You know, something might be wrong.
That's how they found a guy who died on Lone's Peak in Colorado. They looked at his ping and noticed that he hadn't moved in a day it was over like a 12-hour period, and they sent people out and the gentleman had fallen and died.
Yeah.
And I think also in Colorado, I don't know if it's the first, but it's the first that I've heard of that someone fell and succumb to their injuries and they can't get them off the mountain, so they've had to lead them.
Oh wow.
it's so unsafe for the rescuers to try to make way to him that there's nothing they can. Yeah, so the next question, and this is the new question from Henning, that was part of the tradition for the episodes. It's really the same thing. So, like, what is one piece of gear that you would recommend to a new hiker or backpacker?
Let's see. A pack, honestly, a day pack, even if you're doing small hikes, because you could store a lot of things in there. You can store all the water you need. So trying to carry things in your pocket gets super uncomfortable. I know I try to go sometimes with just a smart water bottle and stick it in my back pocket, and I hate that so much. And it makes you kind of vulnerable to things. You could get that caught while you're trying to step up a next step and tweak your back or something. So I'd say having a day pack at least on two mile hikes or more is probably an essential thing.
I was going to show you the Hyperlite Elevate 22 liter is my go-to day pack.
Yeah.
With my Trekker Joe water bottle sleep holders. And can you guess my one piece of gear that I would recommend to a new hiker or backpacker?
You know, I don't know if this is really your answer, but I'm going to say the toothbrush that goes on the spoon.
That is my second. So, Andrew, if you are listening, he's the inventor of Trail Brush. He was on the podcast. You are definitely my second favorite piece of gear. And it definitely, because I always lose my toothbrush, you know, so it's always there with me. But it's the Trekker Joe water bottle sleeve holder. If there's anything that I would recommend that has changed the way I hike and backpack, is that little piece of gear. Weight distribution, if you're having a big water carry, because you have front loaded weight and it's not just all in the back, all on your hips, and you can access it with one hand, do everything. That's my, and one of these days I'm going to start charging Joe like advertising fee, because every episode I talk about it, I'm excited about the product. Yeah, he needs to start paying me for advertisement. And, you know, I should start, when people order, is tell them to make a comment, Trailblazing Texas podcast. So then I can start keeping up with, I need a 10% cut of that profit you're making.
It's funny. At one point, I reached out to a couple people to see if I could be like a product tester or even like a brand ambassador. And they all, I'm nobody. So they, of course, told me like, we don't know who you are. We don't care. But that would be cool. That would be a fun job to basically just be testing a lot of new gear and seeing, this worked really well. This kind of, halfway worked. If you did this, it'd work a little better, but that would be fun, I think.
Hey, I have my first piece of gear that I'm testing for Trekker Joe's. You want to see it?
Yeah, let's see it.
So to the listeners, this is something that I asked Joe at Trekker Joe's just to make me like, can you make me something special? Because I always lose my long handled spoon even though I use pods in my tent, so the organization, but eventually just stuff is everywhere.
Yeah.
So he made me a Dyneema. So it's really fancy. Little bag that holds my long handled spoon.
Nice.
And it has like a little loop. So it, you can put like a little carabiner. And so I can hook this on the outside of my tent or in my tent, up at the top. I can hook it on the outside of my backpack. I usually hook it on the inside of my backpack. But the awesome thing is, here's the trail brush that's already on my spoon. And just so happened, I don't know if he purposely planned this, but just so that the little bag and the trail brush and the spoon all fit together.
Oh, perfect. Nice.
Yeah. So I don't know if this is going to be a product that he produces, but he made it for me and I've tested it. So like I sat here and opened this little snap like 300 times, and so far so good. I've crumbled this up. I've stepped on it. I stuck food in here and let it sit in there for like, you know, three or four days, and then washed it out and used a, you know, a pipe cleaner. And yeah. Oh man, I love this thing. So, nice. So I don't know if he's going to, I need to do a review and tell him what I think, because I haven't done that yet, but yeah, he made that for me and I absolutely love it.
Yeah. I think that's a cool idea too, because yeah, it's pretty easy to lose your spoon in the pockets, or just depending on how you packed it, you know, you might have to dig a bunch of stuff out to get it out. So yeah, having anything that you can access or organize a little bit better just makes everything so much easier to manage.
And what I like about it, it's Dyneema, so it's not going to like rip. Like, you know, sometimes the spoons come with like that, it's not cloth, but you know, whatever material, and they tear and rip, and you know, Dyneema, it's a lot stronger and it just looks badass. So Ryan, I, you know, can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And definitely this can't be the last time that you come on the podcast. You know, thanks as always for being a friend and supporting this endeavor. And before we go, I definitely want you to restate how our listeners can follow you, because if you love rattlesnakes, you will get your fill of rattlesnakes. If you like scorpions, you will see some scorpions. If you like awesome lizards that look really freaky with some cool colors, you'll see that too. And you will see a ton of badass hiking videos and pictures. So let our listeners know again how they can reach out to you, follow you, and connect.
Yeah. Well, first of all, appreciate the invite and the consideration to have me on the show. You know, first time ever doing a podcast, so a little nervous, you know, probably a little.
You rocked it.
You know, just kind of like getting off topic a little bit here and there, you know, but yeah, it's all fun and appreciate it. It's an interesting experience. So, yeah, definitely be game to do it again. So, TikTok and Instagram handle are Leaper2020, and you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok by my name, Ryan Leaper. And everything's public, and feel free to join me on my adventures. I try to post something pretty frequently on there.
Yep. Oh, you do a great job. I mean, you know, I definitely support your stuff, and it's a joy to you know, to really see you out slaying the trails. So again, thanks again for coming on the podcast, and it was wonderful to catch up, and you have a wonderful rest of your night.
All right. You too, Jason.
And that wraps up another exciting episode of the Trailblazing Texas podcast. We hope you enjoyed the episode today, and stay tuned for our next episode, where we will pick back up where we left off and guarantee to uncover many more hiking gems and share many more tips to enhance your experience on the trail. Until then, happy trails and happy hiking.